The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 199.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, a very good friend of mine, one of the smartest people in the macro space without a doubt. His name is Luke Grohman. Luke, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thanks, George. Great to be back.
Okay, now I just got done re-listening to your last interview with our good buddy Eric Townsend. And so I want to kind of explore some of the ideas that you talked about there. The first thing that I'd like you to expand on is the Fed trying to ride two horses with one ass. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, they absolutely, it's in essence Triffin's dilemma. So they want to help stimulate the domestic economy as much as they can. And they also want to make sure the dollar doesn't fall chaotically.
Right.
And when the dollar was, you know, back in March at 98, 99 and rising on the Dixie and the economy was in dire need of stimulus, that was a really easy decision. Those two horses were riding in the same direction. You need to weaken the dollar. You need to stimulate. Great. That's easy. Let's do $625 billion a week in QE. You know, let's. Now that you got down to when I did that interview with Eric, it would have been the Dixie was probably 89, 90 maybe. Now you're getting to technical levels below which you could set off a bit of a disorderly decline in the dollar. And once you get to a disorderly decline in the dollar, you start getting into a risk of touching off what I think is the Fed's worst nightmare, which is capital flight driven declines in asset prices in the United States. In other words, because the US's net international investment position is negative 60% of GDP, which is absolutely unprecedented in US history, if the dollar gets too weak, foreigners that own all those assets will start, they repatriate their investment returns back to their own currencies. And so if they're making 10% in the S&P, but they're losing 12, 15, 20% in the dollar. I don't know what the right amount of disorderly decline in the dollar is, but there is a number where, in theory, where that is true. Then you get into the Fed's worst nightmare where you get stocks down, dollar down, and there's only one way out for them, and that is to significantly raise interest rates, which, of course, isn't really going to help because the government's debt position is so big, they actually would make the situation worse. So once they get to a position where a chaotic or a disorderly decline in the dollar creates a vicious cycle downward in asset prices, they're really in trouble. And so I think that's really their worst nightmare. And so when we go back to March of 2020, it's really easy to supply lots of liquidity because the dollar down and the economy stimulate the economy. Those horses were riding in the same direction. With the Dixie at 88, 89 and the economy still needing lots of stimulus, given where unemployment is, given the rollover in tax receipts and some of the things we're seeing, those horses are now starting to ride in opposite directions. And so they're in a very difficult position. They're painted in a corner. And that's where that comment really comes from. Those are the two horses that are riding in two different directions now.
Talking about the disorderly decline in the dollar, is it the Fed's balance sheet that really matters right there? Or is it the combination of the Fed's balance sheet and the government's balance sheet with the Fed monetizing the newly issued debt?
I think it's a combination of those two things, in addition to, you know, any number of other things, I suppose, as well. But what is, for purposes of what we're talking about here, it really comes down to what we've called, are they going to run the Soros, Druckenmiller, strong dollar playbook, or are they not? And what that is if in the alchemy of finance, George Soros refers to this currency theory. Druckenmiller referred to it again in Market Wizards by Jack Schwager. And the punchline is if you increase fiscal stimulus but tighten monetary policy, you support your currency. You attract capital flows So the Soros-Druckenmiller strong dollar playbook, we saw that in the early 80s where we ran big deficits, but we also tightened monetary policy. Dollar went up strongly. Germans ran it in the late 80s. Same thing happened to the Deutschmark. The last time we did it was in 2Q18 in the U.S., and you saw increasing deficits due to the Trump tax cuts, monetary tightening by the Fed, dollar up, rates up, stocks up until something breaks. And so
the stock market broke.
Yeah, and it was a stock market broke in 4Q18. That's exactly right. And so I think it's those two factors as we're talking about the dollar now. Is it's what's the government doing in stimulus and how much of that stimulus is the Fed buying, and just broken that down into enough and not enough. And in 2020, the Fed bought enough. Dollar went down. In 2021, the plan at this point is for the Fed to not buy enough. It's a little bit black. It's a little bit gray, because then you get into, okay, what's the Fed doing? What's the banking system doing? What is the Treasury doing with the TGA, Treasury General Account rundowns? It's not as crystal clear as it was in 2020. But ultimately, that to me is really the deciding factors. Those are the two big levers in terms of what's the dollar going to do. Is what's the government doing with the fiscal, and what's the Fed doing in terms of effectively monetizing that fiscal?
Yeah, so you don't think the Fed will buy as many bonds moving forward into 2021, or as many newly issued bonds. So I guess the question becomes, what happens to the long end of the curve? Is the market seeing that, or is the market that smart?
I think the market's seeing that a bit. I think it's part of a reflation narrative. I think there's this reflation narrative with the vaccines coming and getting rolled out. I think it's just the bounce back tied to that. But I think it's also partly this, where there is this Soros-Druckenmiller strong dollar playbook that is being run. The dollar's firmed up somewhat, and rates are backing up at the long end, and equities are rising. Asset prices are clearly rising. And so I think that's all part of what we're watching in real time. And the $64,000 question is when does something break? And what is it, you know, what breaks, how quickly, and what will the Fed response be?
Okay, so Luke, when you're talking about something breaking, I'm assuming you're talking about because the 10-year, as an example, gets up to, let's say, 2%, and we see something like we saw in 2018, or we see economic indicators really start to turn down as a result of the interest rates in the real economy just getting more than the real economy can handle. Is that what you're referring to? Or is it maybe the government not being able to turn over their debt at lower interest rates? But I guess that would be the short end of the curve, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be more at the short end for the government. They're really refinancing a lot of it there on an ongoing rolling basis. I think to the prior point of your question, I think that's really where we'll see the biggest problem ultimately. Or that's, I guess, let me put it this way. That would be prime suspect number one, is that the long end will get too high and we'll see some sort of sharp slowdown, probably overseas, probably in emerging markets, where you'll see the first problems. And so I've been watching some of the more sensitive emerging markets there. You know, when you look at things like Argentina or some of these, the weakest emerging markets historically on a current account basis, current account balance basis. So that's probably where you see it first. Right now, it doesn't look to be a problem anywhere, really. When you're seeing energy prices are rising, you're seeing home prices rising, you're seeing everything rise. So I'm open to the possibility that it could be a problem somewhere else. It could be even 2 weeks ago with GameStop, where we had this sort of short squeeze and authorities had to regulators had to kind of step in and sort of adjust the machinery, I guess, if you will. But we had 2 days out of three where the Dow was down 600 plus points. So I'm open to the concept that because we're so far down this rabbit hole, that it could look a little different than it did in 2018 in terms of the long end of the curve rising as being the trigger per se.
How does the long end of the curve affect emerging markets?
Just, I think, in terms of the dollar strength, ultimately, this whole dynamic, it's not just that, but ultimately, it's really, you know, to the extent this Soros-Druckenmiller strong dollar playbook works, dollar, you're taking away dollar capital away from elsewhere. And as that happens, The issue isn't that they're short dollars. They have plenty of dollars. They're net long dollars, really, when you look at their net international, the U.S.'s net international investment position that's negative 60% of GDP or more. If you net that against their debt, their dollar debt, they're net long dollars effectively, but they need to sell those assets to get those dollars. And if they sell those assets to get those dollars, they crash our markets, and our economy doesn't work unless stock markets are rising. So it sets off sort of I won't say a death spiral, but a vicious cycle in the wrong direction, where asset prices down, consumption down, GDP down, tax receipts down, deficits up, we need to issue more debt, and it gets into this problem. So that's really where I think it reflects in the on the emerging market side.
So the Fed's maybe just hoping for this Goldilocks scenario, where the long end of the curve just gradually goes up, but it doesn't, to your point, doesn't make anything break. The stock market doesn't crash, the housing market doesn't crash. We don't see emerging markets blow up if we see the dollar spike, and they can just kind of ride this just bits and pieces of stimulus just to keep the economy, I guess we'll call it functioning in quotes, and then just have the dollar dropping and just keep going back and forth and back and forth. What's the end game there, though? I mean, what are they hoping for? Is that the Hail Mary? Is they're hoping for aliens to come down and help us out with free energy? I mean, what's, or are they just kicking the can down the road and just saying, we'll worry about it later?
I think it's some combination of the Hail Mary and kicking the can down the road. I mean, ultimately, they're acutely aware of the issues. And you know that because of what people like Alan Greenspan, Larry Lindsay, Richard Fisher, Stan Fisher, Yellen, all these people, they get out of office and they get very honest. They understand the problem. But when they're in office, they are as much politicians as they are economists and central bankers. And so they really can't tell you the truth because they're in a political seat. And so they need a massive spike in productivity to get out of the entitlement problem. Barring some sort of free energy, nuclear fusion, rapidly created, distributed, et cetera, that's an issue.
Especially with lockdowns and COVID.
That's very difficult to get. And so, well, I think it really is just trying to sort of kick the can along and hopefully, string it along as long as they can.
You talked about that disorderly drop in the dollar. What does that look like? Because when you were saying that, I'm thinking, okay, back in 2011, I think it was, we got down to about 70 on the Dixie. And I wasn't really studying it back then. I don't know if there was a lot of fear selling dollar denominated assets. I would assume not, because the dollar started to go back up, I think, to most people's surprise, outside of the United States. But what does a disorderly drop in the dollar look like? I mean, is that dropping from 90 to call it 80 in like 2 weeks or something?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think it's a great way of framing it. I think it's both size of the move and speed of the move, I think, are the two key metrics. So yeah, I think if you saw 90 to 80 in a 2 week span, that would get people's attention. Or if you just saw it, I think even where it became easy to bet against the dollar and make money, I think that, so if it went from 90 to 60 over an 18 month span of time, but just every month you just can make, a percent and a half short in the dollar with very little volatility in the other direction, I think that's probably something else that begins to concern them, because it's just the momentum and then the imbalances that creates when you go the other way. So it's, I don't know that they oppose a weaker dollar, but I think they would want it to be more orderly than disorderly. And that probably speaks to the, both gradual nature of it, but then also just keeping people from feeling like they can make a big bet and destabilize, put the system at risk of destabilization by betting against the dollar. So it's almost, two steps down, one step up, two steps down, one step up, two steps down, one step up for some extended period of time. Question is, do they have that much time? And some of that is a function of the productivity dynamics we talked about before and the reopening of the economy. And if you get a big productivity increase, if you get the economy to reopen quickly and maybe more quickly than we think, then they probably have that kind of time. If they don't, they probably don't have that kind of time, just given where debt is, given the obligations, et cetera.
I know Schiff talks about this all the time when he talks about his bear thesis on the dollar, that at some point the foreigners who own dollar denominated assets, they just start to liquidate because they're worried that they're going to continue to lose purchasing power because of the dollar going down relative to their own currency. But he doesn't, at least I haven't heard him talk about specific numbers, but that goes back to what you were saying with foreigners owning. I don't think most people caught that, but foreigners own more dollar denominated debt than Americans own of foreign debt, to the tune of 60% of U.S. GDP. Am I saying that correctly?
No, that's right. And it's not just debt, it's all assets, right? So it's our net international investment position. So foreigners own, negative 60% of our, negative 60%, let me back up. U.S.'s net international investment position is negative 60% of GDP. So foreigners on net own about 12 or 13, maybe $14 trillion more in dollar denominated assets than we own of their assets. And right. The way to think about that is since 2008, that number was maybe negative 8%. So to go from negative 8% to negative 60% over 12 years just means we hocked our family silver for our recovery. So people say, well, America's a better economy because it's recovering faster than the Europeans. And there's certain things where our economy is more dynamic, but I think part of the reason we've recovered so much more rapidly than the Europeans in particular, but other regions as well, has been we've hocked our family silver. We run these big deficits and the dollars end up overseas and then they come back here and people end up buying valuable parts of our, Warren Buffett talked about it in 2005. We equated it to being a farm owner, and basically the farm owner dies, hands off the farm to his kids, and his kids basically throw a giant party. And to pay for the party, the kids start selling off the back 40 acres and the back 80 acres and the back 100 acres. And that's what we're doing. We're selling off our farm to pay for our consumption. And that's what's been happening since 2008. And so ultimately, that's what that net international investment position speaks to.
So you do a lot of homework on China. And a few of my recent whiteboard videos, I was trying to think through the digital yuan and how that plays into the whole Belt and Road initiative. And I started to, and I don't know if I'm thinking it through correctly, but I started to see the digital yuan, the current dollar system, and maybe Bitcoin as competing networks. Like it's not just about a green piece of paper. It's about the whole network that's involved with the whole entire global monetary system, the euro dollar system as an example. But it seems like China could, I don't know if they're doing this intentionally, but it seems like they're creating what could be, and it's probably not now, but what could be in the future, one of these networks. When you look at all the investment positions they have in Africa, in South America, in Eastern Europe, India, that whole Belt and Road initiative, to where if they started rolling out this digital yuan, which they have in China, but if they rolled it out outside of China, then that could create this whole network that maybe in the future could compete with the dollar. The other thing there is they're financing that, or if they would, with the people's, or with the central bank. And they have, an infinite balance sheet. They could compete a lot better, I think, because they could issue loans at interest rates where they don't really have to be paid back. And people are always going to take the cheapest debt. So I know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what they're doing with the central bank digital currency, when you pair it with this regional comprehensive economic partnership or RECEP that they signed in November of last year with, I'll call it, 16 other Asian nations, including notably major U.S. allies, Japan and South Korea. And it's, 40% of global GDP are those nations, and 20-30% of global population, maybe 40% of global population. And then right before Trump left office, they also signed this European investment, agreement in December, early January. So you've got all of a sudden these investment deals that basically stretch across the entirety of Eurasia. Importantly, the RECEP I've seen it now twice, serious people saying that a key component of it is that that trade will be done outside the dollar system, that it'll be done in local currencies. And that's critical, particularly when you then look at it in the context of this digital yuan. I thought that maybe the person who's laid it out best, as I've seen it so far, was Louis Gav at GavCal, who noted that really what they're doing with the central bank digital currency is almost like what Apple did with the iPhone, which was people said, well, Apple's never going to be able to compete with Microsoft on the desktop. The Windows has a dominant monopoly, and Jobs changed the game. So that's fine. Well, we'll do the iOS and we'll do the and now they completely have changed the dialogue, changed the game. And Louis Gav's point was that's what this central bank digital currency, China's in particular, when you marry it with these trade deals, when you marry it with trade outside of the dollar, has the potential to do. Because really, people say, well, what does China have to offer in terms of settlement? And it's a very it's the wrong way, or it's a very U.S.-centric way of looking at things, and it just sort of belies the way currencies and trade have worked, with the exception of the last 50 years. So from 1971 till present, the U.S. has settled these trade imbalances through our capital account, basically exactly what we described with the net international investment position. It was, hey, you send us stuff, we'll send you dollars, and then you invest the dollars in our treasury market and other financial assets. So we balance these imbalances. We imbalance, you know, we consume and we have a party, and then we sell off portions of our assets to foreigners to pay for it. And the Chinese don't want to do that. What the Chinese are doing is, through the RCEP and the European Investment Deal and the central bank digital currency, is they will trade with the Europeans, or they will trade with the Middle East, and they will pay in yuan, or they'll pay in euro, and then the Europeans will trade with the Chinese. So the Chinese might send Huawei equipment to Europe, and Europe might send Mercedes-Benzes back to China. And then there's gonna be a net. And whatever the net is will be tallied in theory on the central bank digital currency in yuan, and it can be settled in gold. It can be settled in, I think it's gonna be settled in gold, any net balances, to be blunt. I think that's really the new central bank FX reserve asset, primary reserve asset, I think, is going to be gold under that system, at least for the time being. So basically what you're talking about, though, is that you're settling trade in goods. There's not this gigantic capital account imbalance that builds up over time, as the U.S. has had, where we just run bigger and bigger and bigger deficits. There is it's a balancing system. And basically, those currencies will trade against each other based on their balance of trade. If China sends a whole bunch of stuff to Europe and Europe's not sending anything back, the euro is going to fall. And through whatever neutral settlement asset there is. And then Mercedes will get really cheap and the Chinese will buy a whole bunch of them, and then it'll balance out. Or maybe there'll be Airbus plane. But in that world, it's really about production. It's really about adding economic value in terms of goods and services offered, and rather than just, you know, consuming and balancing that through the capital account. So I think that's really the central bank digital currency that China's beginning to roll out is, I think, a huge clue in where things are going, which is not that China wants the yuan to take over for the dollar as the dollar's been structured since 1971. I don't think they have any interest in that. What I think it's telling us is we're moving to a multi-currency, a multipolar system where every nation in the SDR basket, the Europeans, the Chinese, maybe the Japanese and the British as well, will be able to buy commodities in their own currency, and then you sort of settle in a neutral settlement asset. But it's this production, it's basically everyone's got to compete on a more level playing field as it relates to the currencies than it stands now.
Yeah, which, to be clear for everyone listening or watching, that's the way it was for hundreds of years. I mean, when you're talking about that, I'm thinking of David Hume's price specie flow model, I think it was called, or method, where, you know, the gold just goes from one country to the other, then they have more money supply, their goods go up, and it kind of equals out over time. Do you think that settlement asset could be, or do you think the IMF wants it to be a digital SDR?
I don't know. I would think they probably would want it to be that, and that could in theory work. Particularly if I was the IMF and said, all right, I am going to, all these imbalances are going to get settled in digital SDRs, yeah. And you have to have digital SDRs to buy oil and natural gas and gold, or, and just pray. And particularly if I set a ratio between the two as the IMF, between, say, oil and gold, but even if you just said, hey, you got to have digital SDRs to buy oil, now all of a sudden, that's basically the petrodollar system run through the SDR.
That's what I've been thinking. I've been thinking that their objective, who knows, but it's to replace the dollar system with the SDR, but then have the individual central banks have their own digital currency. And it kind of just works just like fiat does right now.
It could. And the offshoot of it would be the dollar would collapse against the creditor currencies. Because to your point, it would move the global financial system back to the way it worked, the global currency system back to the way it worked for hundreds, if not thousands of years prior to 71, which is the nations with the best balance of trade and the at the current account level and the biggest pile of reserves had the strongest currency and vice versa. And from 1971 forward, the country with the biggest deficits and the least pile of reserves, the United States, has had the strongest currency by virtue of the way this system has worked. And if we move to a system where we rebalance currencies based on who has the highest current account surplus and who has the biggest pile of reserves, the dollar is the dirtiest dirty shirt by far. It's not even close. I mean, the collapse would be the right word against the euro, against the yuan, against the yen in particular. It would fall against the sterling in all likelihood, based on where the dollar is relative to the sterling and current account balances. But it would collapse against those other three. And I don't know what that looks like, but you basically would have to. The way to think about it is where would the dollar have to fall for the United States to be able to compete with China, Europe, and Japan on a total current account basis, where basically what we make in goods and services balances that out. And it's a big number. I mean, it's a big drop in the dollar implied.
Yeah, but it might not even get there. I don't want to sound too doom and gloom. I'm just trying to think it through out loud. And I know I'm in the comments, people are going to get on me about the fiat currency. I know it's all fiat currency. I was just saying the current fiat currency system relative to this new SDR fiat currency. So I want to be clear there. But as far as just thinking through how far when you were saying that, Luke, I'm thinking, well, how far down does the Venezuelan Bolivar have to go before their exports start to become competitive? and I'm not saying the U.S. is Venezuela, but I am saying that if you don't have that infrastructure of manufacturing already built and you have a high regulatory environment, you have high taxes, I mean, at some point, how your currency doesn't matter, because there's just not going to be any investment to create those factories to make the widgets. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's. I think the point is valid. I think the rough infrastructure of the U.S. I think is better than Venezuela, and I think the rule of law is better. Some of the institutions, etc. So I think you've got some of those baselines, but it's. To be clear, I don't think the U.S. dollar would do a Venezuela, but I think it would. I think we would have a U.S. economy with Venezuelan characteristics or with Argentina characteristics, where
that's probably a better country to serve.
Yeah, you could have. Yeah, you could. It would imply the system of an IMF SDR centric system, basically, like you described. Well, yeah, would imply probably, I don't know, 10 to 20% inflation for 3, 4, 5 years in the United States. I mean, basically your debt markets would be, by the time you were done after 5 years, they would be marked down extraordinarily relative on a real basis relative to where they are today, which, by the way, is what needs to happen. And the government is the biggest debtor. The U.S. government, it would delever the U.S. government enormously. And then they could normalize rates and away we go. It's not altogether different from what Israel went through in the early to mid 80s, where you had, 300-500% inflation for a few years, and they pulled out of it. And basically, I mean, you didn't have, it wasn't Armageddon, it wasn't Mad Max, it was sorry bondholders, you lose, you know. You know, like they said in Animal House, right? You know, you fucked up, you trusted us.
Yeah. How did they pull out of that? Did they just jack interest rates and just like a Volcker thing, or?
Well, here's a really interesting one. You know the name of the guy who wrote one of the really the benchmark studies on how they pulled out of it? There's a guy named Stan Fisher, who just got done serving as the Fed's vice chair. If I'm not mistaken, they basically replaced the currency and raised rates a bunch, you know, did a bunch of labor reforms. You know, part of the problem was you had this sort of cost plus labor situation. And so I think they reformed some of the labor situation and the public unions and weakened them. And, you know, basically did, you know, and I'm not that well versed in it, right, but I think it was, you know, reforming some of the domestic labor side, raising rates. I think they may have reissued the currency, but, you know, they pulled out of it.
Yeah. How much of that do you think is psychological?
I think there's probably a pretty good chunk of that. I think, you know, when you look at the studies, it's everything's fine and then everything's not fine. And then all of a sudden everything's fine again. And it's all, I think it's a big part of it really is that, you know, I think it's part of the reason why it's always been important to keep gold well contained when you read some of the old transcripts of central bankers, everything. And I think it's been really interesting to me to watch Bitcoin, because there's going to come a day where, I mean, we're up to nearly $1 trillion in market cap now on Bitcoin. The dollar has hyperinflated for the last 4 months against Bitcoin.
Right.
It's rising at 50% per month on average since October 1st. How much longer will it rise at 50% per month until it starts to create? Right now, the perception is entirely as if we're looking at the dollar as the center of the world and not the other way around. In other words, if we look at the dollar as the center of the world, then Bitcoin's a bubble and it makes no sense. If we look at Bitcoin as gold, the dollar's hyperinflating, and it's just that Bitcoin is the only temperature gauge that central bankers haven't been able to disable to the warning of what's happening to the dollar. And so to me, it's that, like you said, that shift in perception. If we go from Bitcoin's a bubble to the dollar's hyperinflating, and I don't know what that takes. Is that 2 trillion? Is it 5 trillion? Is it 10 trillion on market cap for Bitcoin? Or is it simply an event, right? We had Elon Musk today come out and say, we bought $1.5 billion. That might be a big moment. If Apple comes out and says, we're going to put 10% of our cash into Bitcoin going forward permanently, you know, could that be an awakening of like, wait a second, that's, if the treasury market is such a good deal, why is Apple taking 10% of their cash and putting it into Bitcoin? That's that, you know, they're just, there will come, if on current course and track, there will come a moment where the cognitive dissonance will get too great and there will be a shift from this is a bubble to, oh God, the dollar's the bubble, and they're getting away from that bubble. And that's, it's psychological in large part.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do you think we've gotten to a point with Bitcoin where we've achieved escape velocity from a standpoint of the government banning it? Because if you've got it, let's just say it's 10% of the balance sheet of the S&P 500, how do you ban that if you're the government? Or do they just treat it as another commodity and just tax the gains? Or, I mean, where do you think we are in that process?
So I wrestle with that a lot. I think we're probably past, if we're not already past, we're very close to being past the point of no return. And the reason I say that is they can't ban it. I mean, they could. They can close the on and off ramps, right? They could say you're not allowed to. We can track where the gains are coming from. And if you cannot put your gains in any bank in the dollar system, they could do that. The challenge is with it being a $1 trillion market cap, if it's a purely equity gain, if nobody in the system has levered up either directly or indirectly as a result of that equity tranche, then they can do that and it won't be a systemic problem. Maybe it'll hit spending a bit, et cetera. But even if it hits spending a little bit, the system's so levered, I don't know that they're in a position, you know, that if you basically take $1 trillion that's sitting in capital right now and say, you can't touch it, it's a ship that's never going that it will never land at any port. And I'm stealing that phrase from somebody who I forget. I apologize if you're watching this and I'm borrowing that phrase without attribution. But, you know, GameStop, which was a non-systemic, small, failing video game company, mall-based video game retailer, and it went up 400%. All of a sudden, we've got the regulators stepping in to like with their hair on fire. And that was nowhere near $1 trillion. And that's where I kind of say, to me, maybe the biggest read of the GameStop situation was, oh my gosh, are we that levered that a short squeeze in a non-systemic mall-based retailer with a, you know, modest size long short equity hedge fund, that within a week and a half, 2 weeks of that thing doing what it did, we needed to change the rules real fast, or we needed to sort of calm things down, hit the circuit breakers to stop things from really getting out of control. And I bring that up by way of answering your question, which is with market cap of Bitcoin at $1 trillion, even if there's people haven't borrowed against that as collateral to a large extent, so it wouldn't directly affect it, you know, there'd be a bunch of people going, great, that was 30% of my net worth. Honey, we're not going out to eat for the next 3 months. And that vacation home we were going to buy, or that car we were going to buy because we had this, we can't do that anymore. And so you see that the consumption, it's $1 trillion, such a big number in a system as levered as ours. I just think we might already be past that point of no return.
Yeah, see, I never looked at it from that angle, though, of the decrease of the purchasing power because the asset goes down. Therefore, the economy really starts to struggle. But let's expand on that, because I know you've done a lot of homework. And I've asked you actually for a few charts in the past on the research you've done with how much the stock market matters to U.S. consumption. So, you know, maybe in GDP terms, I don't know if you have that right off the top of your head. So if the S&P were to go down by, let's say, 50% and just stay there for the next 10 years, you know, what would that do to U.S. consumption? And then the next question becomes, what does it do to the U.S. economy? Then what does it do to tax receipts? And what does that do to deficits? What does that do to the Fed monetizing the debt? What does that do to the yield curve, the dollar, gold, et cetera?
So I think a good way to answer the question is to start back with a little bit of background, which is in 1995, President Clinton signed tax reform legislation that made executive comp over $1 million in cash non-deductible to the corporation. And ironically, he was trying to reduce wealth inequality. The problem is the lobbyists got a hold of it, I'm presuming, and they inserted, or he inserted it. At any rate, he signed the bill that's exempted incentive comp, so stock-based compensation. Mm-hmm. So starting in 95, executives from the C-suite on down began taking an increasing percentage of their comp, not in cash, which was rising, but in stock, right ahead of one of the greatest stock runs in history. So what you can see if you look back, and I've got a chart that shows it, it shows the year-over-year change in U.S. total equity equity index market cap against U.S. year-over-year change in U.S. tax receipts. And from 1970 to 1995, they are sometimes coincidentally correlated, really no correlation. And then beginning right after 95, year-over-year declines in equities began to lead year-over-year declines in tax receipts, and both on the downside and the upside. And they became very correlated with equities leading. And so that, I think, was really the cause of what we've seen since, which is we've looked at it a number of different ways because there's no direct great data. But one way we've looked at it is if you look at net capital gains in the IRS data, net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions as a percent of annual growth in U.S. personal consumption expenditures, or PCE. PCE is consumption broadly defined. It's about a $14 trillion line item in GDP calculations. So what you can say is with it 200% of, with net capital gains plus taxable IRA distributions at 200% of PCE growth, it's basically mathematically impossible for consumer spending to grow if stocks fall and stay down, and just modestly, just fall down modestly and stay down. And that's not to say people are necessarily taking their IRA distributions and buying a boat or a car or healthcare services or all the stuff that's in PCE, but it just is the relative sizes of these two data series. It's just, you know, the size of it means that that's likely the case, that it's mathematically impossible, difficult, if not impossible, for consumer spending to grow if stocks fall and stay down. Now, because consumer spending is at 2/3 of GDP, if consumer spending is not growing GDP, it's almost impossible for GDP to grow. And if GDP is not growing with debt to GDP at 130%, if GDP is not growing, the U.S. is on a path to default on either entitlements or treasury bonds or both. And so that's not going to be allowed to happen. And critically, the net capital gains plus taxable IRA portion, that's 200% of annual PCE growth, that does not include stock options, because the stock options, executive stock options, are taxed as ordinary income. And so it's very difficult to get what that number is and strip it out. But call up Apple, call up Google, call up your big companies and see what they're paying every year in stock comp. It's in the footnotes. They're big numbers, huge numbers. Right. And so it's, and then when you look, another way of looking at it is you look at the percent of taxes paid by bracket, right? So the top 5% of U.S. taxpayers pay 60% of the U.S. individual income taxes, 30% of total taxes. And you can say with a pretty high degree of certainty, those top 5% of taxpayers, they're not making their money on an hourly basis. This is not cash comp by and large. This is incentive, asset price related comp. So there's a lot of ways you can sort of look at it and get directionally accurate, but it all points to the same thing, which is if stocks don't keep rising at a faster and faster rate, the government can't get the tax receipts it needs to service the debt and pay the entitlements.
What I see adding fuel to the fire is it seems like the higher the stock market goes and the worse the real economy does, the more it pulls more of the retail investor into the stock market, which would make that the stock market going higher even more important from the standpoint of consumption. And then when you throw home equity in on top of the stock market, I mean, I can't even, if the stock market is let's just say 30% of consumption as far as the stock market going up, I mean, when you throw in home equity, if that goes down, or I mean, that's got to be at least as much to or add or detract from GDP as far as the consumption as the stock market, I would imagine. But my main point was, I just see, you know, what's going on with GameStop. We hear Robinhood all the time. We hear the Wall Street Bet guys going after AMC or anything. What that just tells me is the real economy is getting worse. The stock market's going up, and the average Joe out there is saying, I can't get ahead, or I can't even keep up with just my job and working additional hours. I've got to become a speculator. I've got to become a gambler.
And there's precedent for this. I mean, I don't think the U.S. is going to become Weimar Germany, but you read the history books, and I had it on my Twitter feed a couple weeks ago. I said, you know, wow, we're only 28 days into 2021. I've already got two squares on, you know, U.S. as Weimar Germany bingo. And it was, you know, they had raided the Reichstag and burned it down. And, you know, and literally in this paragraph before, you know, they were talking about how people were speculating to, you know, create, you know, basically anything to get away from the currency.
Mises Krakow.
I think, again, because the U.S. is the reserve currency issuer, because it's a much more diversified economy, I don't know that it's a one-to-one. I think it's, again, sort of this, you know, Argentina, U.S. with Argentina characteristics, you know, or Argentina with U.S. characteristics. It's not going to be the same. But it's interesting, when you look back to Weimar, what was the problem? The problem was they had massive war reparations. Those war reparations were inflation adjusting. They were owed in gold marks. And not paper marks, gold marks. So the more they printed, the more the liability rose. We have war reparations. They're called entitlements we owe to the baby boomers. People say, well, we owe that to ourselves. It's a currency we can print. No, we do owe it to ourselves, but we can't print healthcare services. Medicare, we owe healthcare goods and services. We don't owe dollars. Social Security, the cost of living or COLA adjustment, yeah, it's understated, but it's still a COLA adjustment. There is an inflation-adjusted component to it. So that's, you know, so we've got, a similarity of this war reparation side. And then you look at when it really got bad there, it was when the Ruhr Industrial Valley was carved off by the French as part of the, when they stopped paying the war reparations. So the French came in and put troops in the Ruhr Valley and said, well, you're not gonna be able to use your industrial capacity anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, now you take away their industrial capacity. They have no capacity to pay the gold marks they couldn't pay in the first place, to earn the gold marks, to pay back the gold marks. So that's where things really went, you know, haywire.
Yeah.
And you look at the U.S., we owe the dollars that we owe. We've got the war reparations, and we've deindustrialized ourselves. A lot of our industrial plant and equipment is sitting in China as a result of the trade deals we've signed and the policies we've made. And so we've hollowed out this, the industrial, to your point earlier, part of the economy that that you need to sort of, you know, to keep things centered. So there are ways in which history is rhyming, is my point. And again, I don't think the U.S. is going full Weimar. I don't think we're going to suffer a currency destroying hyperinflation. But I think what we're seeing are early signs of a version of basically an Argentina with U.S. characteristics. And it's troubling to say, but I think, unfortunately, that's where we're going as a result of the policy choices we've made over the last 30, 40 years of financialization at all costs.
I just want to go back briefly to what we were talking about with the world kind of diversifying the types of currency they're using. Now, whether they're central bank digital currencies, SDRs, who knows what it looks like, but they're kind of gradually, not all at once, but gradually moving away from doing global trade with dollars. What does the euro dollar system look like? Does it just, does that shift as well? So instead of, let's say right now, the euro dollar system, you know, it's these commercial banks are creating dollar denominated loans for foreign corporations or countries, what have you. And so do more of those loans just get issued in different denominations, and the percentage just go down, and we just don't even notice as the dollar goes down gradually, going back to kind of, I don't want to say it's intrinsic value, but maybe it's intrinsic value based on how much stuff the United States actually creates. Is that kind of what it looks like?
I don't know. It's a great question. I really don't know what that looks like. I mean, the euro dollar system as structured right now is both a source of great power to the U.S. historically, but it's increasingly been used against us by China in particular. By that, I mean, they borrow dollars in the euro market. They then lend those euro dollars out at a spread to other weaker EMs with hard asset collateral. If we strengthen the dollar too much, the weaker EMs begin to default. China takes the collateral, which is what they wanted in the first place. When they borrow and buy these hard assets, it increases their geopolitical power and economic clout. And because they're now so big, because we didn't stop this, because we early on in this process, we said, hey, great, China's borrowing euro dollars. It increases our power, our leverage over them. Well, at some point it goes from, the bank owes you $1 million, you owe them, the bank owns you and you owe the bank $1 billion and you own the bank. And that transition was made any number of years ago. So we've seen this over and over where the dollar gets too strong, the euro dollar market starts to have the problems it has, and the Fed steps in and bails out, swap lines for everybody. And people say, well, China doesn't get a swap line. Well, if China's the lender to all these people that need the swap lines, guess where those dollars are flowing? They're all creditors or they're all debtors of China. The dollars are flowing to China. And so basically what you have is China using the euro dollar system to conduct an LBO of the world, increasing their power and clout, backstopped by the Fed.
Right.
The cherry on top of the whole ridiculous sundae is the U.S. military protects the trade lanes for China to bring the stuff back to China.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. And the military, in particular in the U.S., the DOD, certain parts of the intelligence establishment have been saying this doesn't make sense. And they've been saying it for a decade. They've been saying it more loudly with each passing year. It's a national security threat. So now what it's weird because the euro dollar system was forever a national security strength. And now it's a national security threat increasingly as a result of what I just described. And so when you say, what's the euro dollar system look like? I don't know. I mean, I think the way you describe it, I hadn't really thought about it a lot. That would make some sense. The challenge then is you almost have to renegotiate all these contracts. And do you change over the if you change this contract from dollars to euros, then you're changing something else over here. And now you've got more euro exposure than you planned for. And, the euro debt to soak it up. So does the euro actually collapse? It's complex and messy. Or is it just they hit the gas to the floor on this whole thing and the Fed basically ends up having to bail out the whole euro dollar system, which implies a Fed balance sheet of some silly big number. And the Fed balance sheet goes 7 trillion, 8 trillion, 10 trillion, 15 trillion, 30 trillion, 60 trillion. The reality is the dollar probably would fall sharply by that point. But that's the other sort of outcome to it. And I don't know. I hadn't given all your proposal a lot of thought. I think it makes some sense, but it's very complex and it would require like a stable time to do that. And so I would think the time to do that's probably past, unfortunately.
Yeah. And from the standpoint of the corporation or the business, if I'm a Colombian corporation, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm just trying to find the best deal as far as taking out additional debt to buy another factory or something like that. If the dollar's got the best deal, then I'm going to go with that. I think we saw that back in 2011 when interest rates were so low and they thought the dollar was going to continue to go down. Why not buy a falling dollar at 3% interest rate and lock it in or whatever? But I think that's what it goes by. But it is, there's just so many moving parts. So I know we're running short on time, Luke. So I want to get your opinion on stocks, on probably real estate, gold, Bitcoin, bonds. I would assume that your position is similar to last time we spoke, where you're bullish on the stock market, gold, Bitcoin, probably bearish on bonds. But I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, still very bullish on gold, Bitcoin, gold miners, still own silver. I still like stock market, industrials, and tech companies in particular, big tech. I think for me, I would rather hold gold as my bonds. I mean, at the end of the day, they both yield close to the same thing. And my gold or my Bitcoin, for that matter, have way more upside than the bonds do for the same coupon. And that's how I've been thinking about bonds for some time. But it's really sort of continued to be that. Real estate, I think, is a much more localized game. It's always low. It's always location, 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 right? Like the old saw says. But I think it's increasingly true now, just given uneven reopenings from COVID. I think I think COVID blew open some realizations, right? So when you see what was a trickle is now an absolute jailbreak out of Manhattan, out of other high cost, high tax bad weather areas, which I think are sort of the trifecta of bad positions to be in if you're a state or municipality, toward better weather, lower tax, lower cost municipalities. So when you see, you know, Florida, Nashville, Texas, so the Research Triangle and the Carolinas, you know, those types of areas, it's craziness in housing markets. It's probably a great place to be looking at, you know, light commercial real estate, office space, et cetera. I just think it's very, very regionalized rather than broadly saying, hey, I want to own real estate or I don't want to own real estate.
When you say you believe the stock market will be higher, let's say at the end of 2021, 2022, do you think it's higher just in nominal terms or do you think it's higher in real terms?
I think it will be higher in real terms as officials denote CPI, if we put it that way. Will it be higher in real terms? Maybe. Will it be higher in gold terms? Will it be higher in Bitcoin terms? I'd be shocked. So I think Bitcoin goes up the most. I think gold goes up the second most. Commodities probably broadly have a pretty good year this year, depending on what the dollar does. I think it's the commodity, the equity market is increasingly turning into basically a place to deploy money to hedge inflation, to hedge monetary expansion.
Yeah, right. Do you get concerned with Bitcoin in the short term? And the reason I ask that is because long term, I'm very bullish. I've been bullish on Bitcoin and owned it for a long time. But I, regardless of whether it's Bitcoin, gold, silver, any asset class, whenever I see this much emotion and you know, you turn on CNBC and every single commercial is for Grayscale and every single talking head that they bring out is talking about how they're bullish on Bitcoin. You know, that as a contrarian investor, that always kind of makes me a little bit nervous. And I told my good buddy, Chris McIntosh, hedge fund manager, that I say, you know, I like investing in things like coal. You're never going to hear anyone talk about coal on CNBC other than just they hate it and it's uninvestable. And but so you see what I'm saying? So in the short, although I'm very bullish, it's just short term. I'm kind of like, boy, I don't know. It just seems like there's a lot of emotion involved.
Yeah, I don't disagree. For me, I think it's still got room to run, if only because I still see the emotion on the other side, right? The naysayers, there's still quite a bit of Bitcoin, in particular Bitcoin naysayers. They're very passionate as well. And I would look more, I would look less for the effervescence of the Bitcoin supporters, which is always, it's like either, you know, it's very effervescent or off the charts effervescent, right? And it's just, they're always very bullish about it. And I would focus, for me, I would focus more on where are the naysayers. And if the naysayers are quiet or capitulating, that's more where I would get more concerned in terms of just a tactical trading perspective. But I just think it's one of these, when you watch what's happening with the fiscal side, and I'm primarily have been focused on Bitcoin from the fiscal side. When you watch what's happening and how cornered the US really is, how cornered Western social democracies really are,
right?
It's just very, there's a chart I've highlighted for our clients a number of times, and it was by Dan Oliver at Mermican Capital. And it's a tremendous chart. And it shows the price of gold in Weimar Germany in the 20s. And so everyone thinks of that as, well, you know, the currency went to zero, right? Gold went to $1 trillion. And what you realize is that if you were levered in gold, and it you literally lost all your money four or five times as the currency went to zero. And so I just think it's very, be prepared for face ripping volatility in Bitcoin, gold in particular, but the fiscal side, I think, is really the big gear where you just have to understand that the U.S. cannot abide positive real rates. And so you're going to get these counter moves, but that's the problem. They've got to get increasingly negative real rates. And that's an environment where you want to own Bitcoin, gold, but you just want to keep it very, very low over your skis with the leverage so you don't get shaken out at the wrong time. That's how I'm looking at it, is just basically steeling myself for that volatility rather than trying to trade that volatility, because it's an asset class where you sell it, drops a little, and you go, oh, great. And then it goes up way past your And then it's super hard to get back. Even if you want to get back in, it's super hard to get as much as you once owned. So I think that's more how I've looked at it.
Yeah, got it. So the key takeaway with Bitcoin is when Peter Schiff buys, then Luke Roman might think about selling, right? I'm giving a hard time. Peter's a great buddy of mine, and I'm sure he'll take that in stride. But I guess that's the indicator. All right, Luke, I appreciate your time, man. For my audience who wants to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Absolutely. Check us out at fftt-llc.com. There's a information about what we're up to, and then also more information about both our institutional and retail research product offerings at that website. You can also follow me on Twitter at Luke Groman, LukeGromen, and fairly active feed there, as you know, George. So you check out what we're saying there as well.
All right, Luke, I appreciate your time. I can't wait to do it again, buddy.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, George. It was great catching up, bud.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.